Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Egypt podcast. This is a mini episode, a short break from our regular narrative to explore a side topic that is interesting or curious from Egyptian history. Today, we are exploring an ancient Egyptian fairy tale, commonly called The Story of the Doomed Prince. This was a story composed at some point during the New Kingdom. It is most likely of the 18th dynasty, but the surviving papyrus, which is the only copy, comes from a later date. It's possible it was composed sometime around the reign of Akhenaten or slightly later. This is because it is written in the late Egyptian style, which became popular or prominent around this period. So the story may have been composed, or at least written down, around 1350 BCE, approximately. The story of the Doomed Prince is similar in some respects to the famous Tale of Sinuwe, particularly in the fact that it involves an Egyptian travelling abroad to the Near East in order to escape some doom or threat of which he is afraid. Where it differs is in its motivations. While Sinuwe flees from Egypt, afraid of punishment in the wake of a pharaoh's assassination, the Doomed Prince leaves Egypt voluntarily, exploring the world, trying to enjoy his life before the doom that is promised falls upon him. The story wrestles with concepts of fate and the extent to which a person's life is preordained from their birth. The prince himself is supposedly fated to death by one of three means, and the story is built around his attempts to A. escape those fates, B. enjoy his life as best he can, and C. the means by which he can find accommodation with the supernatural beings who are determining the end of his life. It is not a long tale, and as you will see, it ends rather abruptly, but it is an interesting meditation on Egyptian conceptions of predestination and how they perceived the role of destiny or fate within their own lives. Perhaps the story was meant to provide comfort to the listener, a sense that they still had some control over their lives. Or perhaps it was a simple fairy tale, a story of humans and gods interacting in the most fantastical ways. Whatever the moral is intended to be, the tale of the Doomed Prince is a fascinating example of Egyptian storytelling and one well worth our attention. That's enough introduction. Now, let me tell you a story. It is said that once upon a time there was a king to whom no son had been born. His majesty begged a son for himself from the gods of his domain, and they decreed that one should be born to him. That night he slept with his wife, and she became pregnant. When she had completed the months of childbearing, a son was born. Then the seven Hathors came to determine a fate for the new prince. They said, "He will die through a crocodile, or a snake, or a dog." When the people who were with the child heard this, they reported it to His Majesty. As a result, His Majesty's heart became very sad. He had a house of stone built for the prince upon the desert, supplied with people and with every good thing of the palace, and the child was not allowed to go outdoors. Now, when the boy had grown, he went up to his roof, and he saw a dog following a man who was walking on the road. He said to his servant who was beside him, "What is that thing that is walking behind the man who is coming along the road?" The servant told him, "That is a dog." The boy said to him, "Have one like it brought to me." Then the servant went and reported this to His Majesty. His Majesty said, "Bring him a little puppy so that his heart will not grieve." They brought him a little puppy. Now, when many days had passed and the boy was fully grown in all of his body, he sent a message to his father, saying, "To what purpose is my sitting here? I am committed to fate. Let me go, so that I may act according to my heart, at least until the god does what is in his heart. Then a chariot was harnessed for him, equipped with all sorts of weapons, and a servant was given to him as an attendant. The prince was ferried over to the eastern shore of the Nile, and he was told, "Go wherever you wish." His dog was with him. The prince went northward across the desert, following his heart and living on the best of all the desert game. Eventually, the prince reached the land of Naharin. Now the prince of Naharin had no children except for one daughter. For her, a house had been built whose window was 70 cubits away from the ground. The prince of Naharin had sent for all the sons of all the princes around and told them, "He who reaches the window of my daughter, his wife she shall be." Princes came from all around and attempted to reach the daughter's window. Now, when many days had passed and they were at their daily pursuit, the Egyptian prince passed by him. They took the prince to their house, they washed him, they gave food to his team of horses. They did everything for the prince. They anointed him, they bandaged his feet, and they gave food to his attendant. They said to him, by way of conversation, "Good youth, whence have you come?" The prince replied to them, falsely, hiding his identity. He said, "I am the son of an officer of the land of Egypt. My mother died, my father took another wife as a stepmother, but she came to hate me, and I went away, fleeing from her." They believed him, and they embraced him and kissed him on all of his body. Now, when many days had passed, the prince said to these other princes, "What is it that you are doing here?" They said, "For 3 months now we have been here, trying to leap, for he who reaches the window of the daughter of the prince of Naharin will get her as his wife." The Egyptian said to them, "If only my feet did not hurt, I would go leaping with you." The foreign princes went leaping in their daily manner, while the Egyptian stood at a distance watching, and the gaze of the daughter of the prince of Naharin fell upon him. When many days had passed, the Egyptian prince came to leap with the sons of the princes. He leaped, he reached the window of the daughter of the prince of Naharin. She kissed him, she embraced him on all of his body. He went to inform her father and told the prince of Naharin, "One man has reached the window of your daughter." The prince questioned him, saying, "Which prince's son has done this?" The Egyptian said to him, "It is the son of an officer who came fleeing from Egypt, fleeing from his stepmother." Believing this, the prince of Naharin became exceedingly angry. He said, "Am I to give my daughter to a fugitive from Egypt? Make him go away." The foreign princes went and told the Egyptian, "Go back where you came from." But the daughter held his hand, and she swore by the god, saying, "As Re Horakhti lives, if he is taken from me, I shall not eat, I shall not drink, I shall die right away." A messenger went and reported to her father every word that the daughter of Naharin had said. And her father sent men to kill the Egyptian prince on the spot. But the daughter said once again, "As Re lives, if they slay him, when the sun sets, I shall be dead. I will not live an hour longer than he." They went to tell this to her father. Then her father had the Egyptian prince brought before him, together with his daughter. And when the youth stood before him, his dignity impressed the prince of Naharin. The elder embraced the youth, and he kissed him on all of his body, and he said to him, "Tell me about yourself, for you are now my son." The prince replied, "I am the son of an officer of the land of Egypt. My mother died, my father took another wife. She came to hate me, and I left fleeing from her." Then the prince of Naharin gave him his daughter as wife. He gave the prince of Egypt a house and fields, as well as cattle and all sorts of good things. Now, when many days had passed, the youth said to his wife, "I am given over to 3 fates. The crocodile, the snake, or the dog are destined to kill me." She replied to him, "Well, have the dog that follows you killed." And he said to her,
What foolishness! I will not let my dog be killed, one whom I raised when it was a puppy. So the daughter began to watch her husband very much, and she did not let him go out alone. Now on the day when the youth had left Egypt in his wandering, the crocodile, his fate, had followed him. The crocodile came to be opposite him in the village in which the youth was living, and it dwelled within the lake. But there was a demon within the crocodile. The demon did not let the crocodile come out of the water, nor did the crocodile let the demon come out to stroll about. As soon as the sun rose, the demon and the crocodile stood and fought each other every day for 3 months. When more days had passed, the youth sat down to a holiday in his house. When night came, he lay down on his bed, and sleep overwhelmed his body. Then his wife filled a bowl with wine and another bowl with beer. By her doing this, a snake came out of its hole to bite the youth, but the wife was sitting beside him and not sleeping. She placed the bowls of beer and wine before the snake, and it drank. It became drunk, and it lay down on its back. Then the woman hacked it to pieces with her axe. Doing this, she woke her husband, and she said to him, "Look, your God has given one of your fates into your hand. Surely he will protect you from the others as well." The Egyptian prince made an offering to Re, praising him and extolling his might every day. When many more days had passed, the youth went out for a pleasure stroll on his estate. The wife did not go out with him, but his dog was following him. Then his dog began to speak, and it said, "I am your fate." The prince was frightened, and he ran before the dog. He reached the lake. He descended into the water in flight. Then the crocodile seized him and carried him off to where the demon was waiting. But the demon was gone. The crocodile said to the youth, "I am also your fate, one that has come after you. But for 3 months now I have been fighting with the demon. Look, I shall release you. If my enemy returns to fight, then you can help me kill this demon." And so it was that the next day the demon came and returned. Incredibly, the story ends there, on a cliffhanger. It doesn't end intentionally. The papyrus on which it is preserved is damaged and breaks off at this point. Because it has the nature of a fairy tale, we can assume that it ended happily. Perhaps the prince and the crocodile were able to defeat the demon, and the dog may have waited loyally until the prince was an old man before finally taking him off to his fate. Fortunately, the prophecy which the seven Hathors had made that he would die by crocodile, snake, or dog was appropriately vague and did not specify the time in which it would occur. So it's quite likely the doomed prince was not so doomed after all. Eventually, he may have lived a happy and full life, and quite possibly returned to Egypt to take up his throne as the king. Unfortunately, for now, we do not know the ending, but I like to think that the prince was happy ever after, along with his wife, and that their marriage unified the kingdoms of Naharin, or Mitanni, with the land of the Nile. The tale shares a number of motifs which you can find in fairy stories more generally. There is a nice prophecy when the child is born, and there are talking animals and a case of secret identity which is revealed at just the right moment. There is a princess in a tower whom the protagonist must reach by a feat of great endurance and skill. Some classic elements which we might know so well we don't even think about them show up more than 3,000 years ago. Simple proof that the stories we take for granted have an exceptionally long history. Hello, and welcome to the History of Egypt podcast. This is a mini episode, the tale of two brothers, recounting a fairy tale which emerged during the New Kingdom around the late 18th or early 19th dynasties. It is a story of magic, of betrayal, of falsehood,
and of great adventures, both in Egypt and foreign lands. In this story, we're going to see how a man who is wronged by others comes to great triumphs and is able to overcome even death itself. The Tale of Two Brothers is a fascinating piece of ancient Egyptian storytelling. It has been called the oldest fairy tale in the world, and as we will see, it is a story rich in mythological references, full of excitement and adventure, and one which ties in to some of the most fundamental concepts in Egyptian philosophical thought. In this holiday season, sit back, put your feet up, and enjoy a fairy tale from 3,300 years ago. The Tale of Two Brothers focuses in particular on two brothers. Their names are Anubis and Bata. These are no ordinary names, they are divine names. Anubis, of course, is the famous jackal deity, lord of embalming and protector of the dead. Bata, meanwhile, was a provincial god. His name was probably pronounced Biti, and he was the lord of the town called Saka in southern Egypt. So Anubis and Bata are both fictional characters in the story, and also real gods who were worshipped in different communities in the land. The story begins on a small farm in an unnamed part of the country. Anubis and Bata live together, along with Anubis's wife, and the two brothers take care of the crops and the animals. This country estate, this idyllic home, is the setting for our tale's beginning. Quote, "It is said that there were two brothers of the same mother and the same father. The elder brother was named Anubis, and the younger brother was named Bata. As for Anubis, he had a house and a wife, and his younger brother Bata was with him as if he were a son. Bata was the one who made clothes for him, and he went behind his cattle to the fields. Bata was the one who did the ploughing, and he harvested for him. He was the one who did all kinds of labor in the fields. Indeed, this young brother was an excellent man. There was none like him in the whole land, for a god's strength was within him." Now, when many days had passed, this young brother was tending to his cattle according to his daily custom. And he returned to his house in the evening, laden with all kinds of field plants, and with milk, with wood, and with every good thing. He placed them before his elder brother Anubis, as he was sitting with his wife. Then Bata drank and ate and went to sleep in the stable among the cattle. Now when it had dawned and another day had come, Bata took foods that were cooked and placed them before his elder brother Anubis. Then Bata took bread for himself for the fields, and he drove his cattle and he let them eat in the fields. Bata walked behind his cattle, and they would say to him, "The grass is good in such and such a place." And he heard all that the cattle said, and he took them to the place of good grass which they desired. Thus the cattle that he tended became exceedingly fine, and he increased their offspring very much. Now at ploughing time, Bata's elder brother Anubis said to him, "Have a team of oxen made ready for us for ploughing, for the soil has emerged from the flood, and it is right for ploughing. Also, come to the field with seeds, for we shall start ploughing tomorrow." This is what Anubis said to Bata. Then the young brother made all the preparations that his elder brother had told him to make. Now, when it had dawned and another day had come, they went to the field with their seeds, and they began to plough. And their hearts were very pleased with this work that they had undertaken. And many days later, when they were still in the field, they had need of more seeds. So Anubis sent his young brother, saying, "Hurry, fetch us seed from the village." Bata went at his command, and the younger brother then found the wife of his elder brother seated and braiding her hair. Bata said to the wife, "Get up, give me seed, so that I may hurry to the field, for my elder brother, your husband, is waiting for me. Don't delay." The wife said to him, "Go and open the storeroom and fetch what you want. Don't make me leave my hairdo unfinished."
The young brother entered the stable and fetched a large vessel, for he wished to take a great quantity of seed. Bata loaded himself with barley and emma and came out with it. Thereupon the wife said to him, "How much is that which you have on your shoulder?" He said to her, 3 sacks of emma and 2 sacks of barley, 5 in all, are upon my shoulder." This is what he said to her. Then the wife spoke to Bata, saying, "There is great strength in you. I see your vigor daily." And she desired to know him as a man. She got up, took hold of him, and said, "Come, let us spend an hour lying together. It will be good for you, and if you do, I will make fine clothes for you." End quote.
So, we have a complicated situation. Bata lives with his elder brother Anubis and Anubis's wife, who is unnamed. Bata cares for Anubis's household. He tends his cattle, sows his crops. He is a loyal brother who does his duty, and Anubis in turn cares for him. Anubis and the wife take care of Bata as if he is their own son. But one day, as Bata returns from the field, he finds the wife alone braiding her hair. The wife observes Bata as he does his chores, and she notes his great strength, his obvious virility. In a moment of pure femme fatale, the wife invites Bata to join her for an hour of passion. The wife is part of an Egyptian tradition of condemning women who practice adultery. In religious literature and educational texts, scribes warn their readers against women who stray outside the marriage. The Book of the Dead, for example, includes a section where the deceased must confirm that in life, quote, "I did not have sex with a married woman," end quote. Great sages like Tahotep said that sex with a married woman was, quote, "a short moment that is like a dream, but death comes from having known her." And the scribe Ani said that a woman away from her husband was, quote, "like a deep water whose course is unknown." In other words, conservative Egyptian scribes concerned with morality castigated the woman who has sex outside of her marriage. It is a recurring motif, and a fairly hypocritical one. We do not see men condemned for the same behavior. The wife presents her proposition, and Bata must now respond. Quote,
"Then the youth Bata became like a leopard in his anger over the wicked speech she had made to him, and she became very frightened. He rebuked her, saying, 'Behold, you are like a mother to me, and your husband, my brother, is like a father to me. He who is older than I has raised me, cared for me. What is this great wrong you say to me? Do not say it to me again, but I will not tell it to anyone. I will not let it come from my mouth to any man.' He picked up his load. He went off to the field. He reached his elder brother, and they began to work at their task. When evening had come, his elder brother returned to his house, and Bata tended to his cattle, loaded himself with all things of the field, and drove the cattle before him to let them sleep in their stable in the village. Now the wife of the elder brother was afraid on account of the speech which she had made. So she took fat and grease, and made herself appear as if she had been beaten, in order to tell her husband, "It was your young brother who beat me." Her husband returned in the evening according to his daily custom. He reached his house and found his wife lying down and seeming ill. She did not pour water over his hands in the usual manner, nor had she lit a fire for him. His house was in darkness, and she lay vomiting. Anubis, her husband, said to her, "Who has had words with you?" She said to him, "No one has had words with me except for your younger brother, Bata. When he came to take seed to you, he found me sitting alone. He said to me, 'Come, let us spend an hour lying together. Loosen your braids.' This is what he said to me, but I would not listen to him. I said to him, 'Am I not like your mother? Is your elder brother not like a father to you?' At that, he became frightened, and he beat me, so as to prevent me from telling you this. Now if you let him live, I shall die. Look, when he returns, do not let him live, for I am ill from his evil design, which he was about to carry out in the morning." The elder brother became enraged like a leopard. He sharpened his spear and took it in his hand. Then the elder brother stood behind the door of his stable in order to kill his young brother when he came home in the evening to let his cattle over the threshold. When the sun had set, the younger brother, Bata, loaded himself with all the plants of the field according to his daily habit. He returned, and as the leading cow was about to enter the stable, she, the cow, said to Bata, "Behold, your elder brother is waiting for you with his spear in order to kill you. Run away from him!" Bata heard what his lead cow had said, and when the second cow went in, she said the same thing. He looked under the door of his stable and saw the feet of his elder brother as Anubis stood behind the door with his spear in his hand. Bata set his load upon the ground and took off at a run so as to flee, and his elder brother came after him with his spear.
End quote. Uh-oh, we are in a tricky situation here. Anubis believes the falsehood of his wife and goes after his brother in a rage. Bata, returning with the cattle, is oblivious to the situation, and when Anubis hides, waiting for him, Bata almost walks into the trap. Fortunately, two cows notice the waiting Anubis and tell Bata what is happening. Forewarned, the younger brother is able to flee, with Anubis in hot pursuit. The fairy tale elements of the story are in full swing. Magical elements speak to Bata, warning him of impending catastrophe. And Anubis, who really should know better, somehow believes his wife instantaneously. Rather than question her and ask whether his younger brother, who so far has been utterly loyal, would do something like this, Anubis takes the bait without a second thought. The first act thus sets the scene and helps us understand that the story takes place outside of our own time and space. Elements of the magical, the supernatural, will be a strong player in what is to come. Quote,
"As he ran, Bata prayed to Pray Horakti, saying, 'My good lord, it is you who judge between the wicked and the just.' And Pray heard all of his plea, and Pray made a great body of water appear between him and his elder brother Anubis, and the water was full of crocodiles. Thus, one brother came to be on one side, and the other brother on the other side. And the elder brother struck his own hand twice in frustration because he had failed to kill Bata. Then the young brother called to him on this side, saying, 'Brother, wait here until dawn. When the Aten has risen, I shall contend with you before him, and he shall make the wicked submit to the just. For I shall not be with you any more. I will not be in this place in which you are. I will go to the Valley of the Trees.' Now when it dawned, and another day had come, and Pray Horakti had risen, one brother gazed at the other. The youth rebuked his elder brother, saying, 'What is this, your coming after me to kill me wrongfully, without having listened to my words? For I am yet your young brother, and you are like a father to me, and your wife is like a mother to me. But when I was sent to fetch seed by you for us, your wife said to me, "Come, let us spend an hour lying together." But look, it has all been turned around for you into another thing, the opposite of the truth.' And then Bata let Anubis know all that had transpired between Bata and the wife. And he swore by Pray Horakti, saying, 'As for your coming to kill me wrongfully, brother, you carried your spear on the testimony of a filthy whore.' Then he took a reed knife, cut off his penis, and threw it into the water, and a catfish swallowed it. Bata grew weak and became feeble, and his elder brother Anubis became very sick at heart and stood weeping for him loudly. He could not cross over to where his young brother was on account of the crocodiles. After a time, the young brother Bata called out to Anubis, saying, 'If you recall something evil, brother, will you not also recall something good, or something that I have done for you? Go back to your home, tend your cattle, for I shall not stay in the place where you are. I shall go to the Valley of the Trees. But what you shall do for me is to come and look after me when you learn that something has happened to me. I shall take out my heart and place it on top of the flowers of the tree. If the tree is cut down and falls to the ground, you shall come to search for it. If you spend 7 years searching for it, let your heart not be disgusted. And when you find my heart and place it in a bowl of cool water, I shall live again to take revenge on him who has wronged me. You will know that something has happened to me when one puts a jug of beer in your hand and the beer ferments. Do not delay at all when this happens to you." Then Bata went away to the Valley of the Trees, and his elder brother Anubis went back to his home, his hand on his head and smeared with dirt. When Anubis reached his house, he killed his wife. He cast her to the dogs, and he sat mourning for his young brother. End quote. Bata flees and almost falls to Anubis' wrath, but the great god Ra Horakhti intervenes and protects the younger brother. Ra waves his hand and creates a river between the two. Forced to wait it out, Anubis and Bata watch each other across the river. Bata knows that he must prove his loyalty, and he does so with a dramatic gesture. Bata cuts off his own penis and throws it into the river, where a fish swallows it. This is probably a reference to the myth of Osiris, whose own penis disappeared in the Nile following Seth's cruel betrayal. Bata, fortunately, escapes the tragedy of Osiris and is able to prove to his brother that his loyalty is beyond reproach. Nevertheless, Anubis is distraught, and in his rage, he returns home to do justice on the unfaithful wife. This is the end of part one, or act one, in the story. There are three distinct sections in total, each taking place in a different region and focusing on a different challenge which the young brother Bata must overcome. Classic hero's journey stuff, which I can imagine someone like David Lynch making into a pretty interesting film. Anyway, Bata now leaves Egypt and travels to a faraway country, the Valley of the Ash, or Pine Trees. Quote, "Now many days after this, the young brother Bata was in the Valley of the Trees. There was no one with him, and he spent the days hunting the desert animals. In the evening, he returned to sleep under the trees on top of whose blossom his heart had rested. After many days, he built a house for himself with his own hands in the Valley of the Trees. It was filled with all good things, for here he wished to set up a household. One day, coming out of his house, Bata encountered the Ennead, the Divine Council, as they walked about administering the entire land. The Ennead of the gods addressed him in unison, saying, 'O Bata, bull of the Ennead, are you alone here, having left your town on account of the wife of Anubis, your elder brother? Do you not know? He has killed his wife, and you are avenged of all the wrong that was done to you.' And as they felt sorry for him, Pre Horakhti said to the god Khnum, 'Fashion a wife for Bata, so that he does not live alone.' Then Khnum, the fashioner, made a companion for Bata, who was more beautiful in body than any woman in the whole land, for the fluid of every god was within her. Then the seven Hathors came to see her, and they said with one voice, 'This lady will die by the knife.'" End quote. So Bata leaves Egypt, travelling to the place called the Valley of the Pine. The pine, or ash, is generally associated with Lebanon and the great city of Byblos, which traded high-quality timber with the Egyptians ever since the Old Kingdom. Moving to Lebanon, Bata follows the tradition of heroes like Sinuwe or even Osiris, both of whom wound up in this part of the world. Bata and Sinuwe have something in common. They are both fugitives, looking to start anew, far away from the troubles they found in Egypt. And just as Sinuwe settled and then established a new household, Bata would do the same. Only this time, the gods were willing to help. The gods fashioned a wife for Bata. Once again, the woman is unnamed, anonymous. And you won't be surprised if I tell you that this wife also is going to cause Bata a lot of trouble. As the new wife comes into existence, the seven Hathors, a group of oracles or fates, pronounce the destiny of the young lady. She will meet a terrible end, a victim of royal justice. With that ominous declaration in mind, the story moves into its second phase. Quote, "Bata desired his wife very much. She sat in his house while he spent the day hunting the desert game, bringing it and putting it before her. He said to her, 'Do not go outdoors, lest the sea should snatch you. I cannot rescue you from the sea, because I am a woman like you, and my heart lies on top of the flower of the tree. But if another should find my heart, I shall fight with him." Then he revealed to her all of his thoughts.
End quote. Bata and his wife live together for a while, and Bata is, once again, a loyal and helpful man. He brings the food, he builds the house, he supplies almost everything that a lady might need. But there is one thing he can't provide. Because Bata cut off his penis back in Egypt, he is no longer a man in the traditional sense. This doesn't seem to be an immediate problem, but it may have a hand in what happens next. Quote,
"Now many days after this, when Bata had gone hunting according to his daily habit, the young girl went out to stroll under the trees which were next to her house. Then she saw the sea surging behind her, and she started to run before it, fleeing to her house and entering it. Thereupon the sea called out to the trees, saying, 'Catch that girl for me!' And the trees took away a lock of the girl's hair. The sea brought the girl's hair to Egypt, and laid it in the place where the washermen of Pharaoh did the laundry. Soon the scent of her hair got into the clothes of the Pharaoh, and the king quarreled with his washermen, saying, 'There is a scent of ointment in my clothes every day.' He quarreled with them, and they did not know what to do. The chief of the royal washermen went to the shore, his heart very sore on account of the daily quarrel with Pharaoh. Then the man realized that he was standing on the shore opposite the lock of hair which was in the water. He had someone go down, and it was brought to him. Its scent was found to be very sweet, and he took it to the Pharaoh. Then the learned scribes of Pharaoh were summoned, and they said, 'As for this lock of hair, it belongs to a daughter of Pre-Harakhti, in whom there is the fluid of every god. It is a greeting to you from another country. Let envoys go to every foreign land to search for this girl. And as for the envoy who goes to the Valley of the Trees, let many men go with him to fetch her.' His Majesty said, 'What you have said is very good.' And the envoys were sent."
End quote. Once again, we have a supernatural occurrence. Bata's wife goes for a walk in the countryside and finds herself near the sea. Magically, the ocean itself rises up, desiring the wife, and it pursues her inland. She escapes, but not before the sea gets a hold of a lock of hair. This hair floats all the way to Egypt, where the intoxicating scent of its perfume comes to the attention of Pharaoh himself. Filled with desire, the king of Egypt commands his men to go forth and find this mystery woman, the one who smells like every good thing. The wife's hair is almost certainly magical, since the gods themselves made the wife, and she contains a little bit of all of their essences. She is essentially an avatar of desirability. It's a shame that Bata can't perform his manly duties with her, because this woman seems to be operating on Hathor levels of sexuality. Did you ever read the novel Perfume by Patrick Susskind? It's like that. The essence of beauty has been distilled down into this lady's scent so completely that it fills everyone with desire to possess her. So naturally, the Pharaoh's warriors and agents go on the hunt for the mystery woman who smells like a goddess. Quote,
"Now many days after this, the men who had gone abroad returned to report to His Majesty. But those who had gone to the Valley of the Trees did not return, for Bata had killed them, leaving only one of them to report to His Majesty. So His Majesty sent many soldiers and charioteers to bring her back, and with them was a woman into whose hand one had given all kinds of beautiful ladies' jewellery. This woman returned to Egypt with the daughter of Pre-Harakhti, and there was jubilation for her in the entire land. His Majesty loved his new girl very, very much, and he gave her the rank of great lady. He spoke with her in order to make her tell him about her husband, and she said to His Majesty, 'Have the pine tree felled and cut up.' The king sent soldiers with their tools to fell a pine tree. They reached the pine, they felled the blossom on which was placed Bata's heart, and he fell dead at that moment."
So let me rewind. Back in the first act, Bata asked his brother Anubis something important. Bata said that one day, Anubis would need to come looking for him. This would happen when someone destroyed Bata's heart by cutting down a pine tree. Well, that prophecy has now come true. The soldiers cut down the tree on which Bata has placed his heart, trying to keep it safe. Unfortunately, by doing this, they have disconnected his body and his soul, and the man falls dead in an instant. What will happen to Bata? How will he recover? Well, let's find out. Quote,
when it had dawned and the next day had come and the pine tree had been felled, Anubis, the elder brother of Bata, entered his house. He sat down to wash his hands. He was given a jug of beer, and it fermented. He was given another of wine, and it turned bad. Then he took his staff and his sandals, as well as his clothes and his weapons, and he started to journey to the Valley of the Trees. He entered the mansion of his young brother and found Bata lying dead on his bed. Anubis wept when he saw his young brother lying dead. He went to search for the heart of his young brother beneath the pine under which his young brother had slept in the evening. Anubis spent 3 years searching for the tree without finding it. When he began the fourth year, Anubis's heart longed to return to Egypt, and he said, I shall depart tomorrow. So he said in his heart. When it had dawned and another day had come, he went to walk under the pine and spent the day searching for it. When he turned back in the evening, he looked once again in search of it, and he found a fruit. He came back with the fruit, and it was the heart of his young brother. Anubis fetched a bowl of cool water, placed it in it, and sat down according to his daily habit. When night had come, Bata's heart in the bowl swallowed the water, and Bata twitched in all his body. He began to look at his elder brother while his heart was still in the bowl. Then Anubis took the bowl of water in which was placed the heart of his young brother and let Bata drink it. Then his heart stood in its proper place and Bata became as he had been. Thereupon the two brothers embraced one another and they talked.
End quote. So Anubis finds the brother's heart shriveled and desiccated upon the ground. He places it within a bowl of water, where the heart absorbs the moisture and recovers something of its strength. Anubis then pours the heart water into his brother's body, and thus the body and soul are reunited and Bata is able to live once more. So the agents of Pharaoh cut down Bata's pine tree, killing him, and this monstrous act seems to be yet another injustice done to Bata, the second of three which will happen in the story. Fortunately, like the best soap operas, Bata's death is temporary. He returns to life with his brother's help, and Anubis, who, remember, is associated with the protector deity of the dead, assists Bata in his moment of crisis. The audience would probably understand the connection going on here. Anubis, a god of the dead, helps a soul return to life and thus undo a great crime. The reunification of Bata and Anubis marks the end of part 2 in the three-act structure. The brothers are challenged in part 1 and fall out. In part 2, they are brought back together and their bond is stronger than ever. Now, with Bata once again facing great difficulty, the two must overcome falsehood and restore justice. Fortunately, they can now work together and their powers are greater than ever before. Quote,
then Bata said to his elder brother, look, I shall change myself into a great bull of beautiful colour, of a kind unknown to man, and you shall sit on my back. By the time the sun has risen, we shall be where my wife is, so that I may avenge myself. You shall take me to where the king is, for he will do for you everything good. You shall be rewarded with silver and gold for taking me to Pharaoh. For I shall be a great marvel, and they will jubilate over me in the whole land. Then you shall depart to your village. When it had dawned, and the next day had come, Bata assumed the form of a bull which he had told his elder brother. Then Anubis sat upon his back. At dawn, Bata reached the place where the king was. His majesty was informed about the bull. He saw him and rejoiced over him very much. The king made a great offering for him, saying, this is a great marvel. And there was jubilation over Bata in the entire land. Then the pharaoh rewarded Anubis, the elder brother, with silver and gold, and he went to dwell in his village. The king gave Anubis many people and many things, for Pharaoh loved him very much, more than anyone else in the whole land. End quote. At this point in the story, the supernatural elements are coming thick and heavy. Bata shapeshifts, turning himself into a bull. We've seen this idea before, when the dueling gods Horus and Seth went to war for the kingship. In a competition, Horus and Seth transformed themselves into hippopotami. Well, Bata does the same, but he becomes a bull, one of the traditional symbols of Egyptian kingship. Naturally, the pharaoh recognizes the value of this symbol, and he welcomes Bull Bata into his household. For the next wee while, things seem pleasant in the story, at least until treachery strikes once again. Quote, "Now, when many days had passed, he, Bata, entered the kitchen, stood where the lady was, and began to speak to her, saying, 'Look, I am yet alive.' She said to her, 'Who are you?' He said to her, 'I am Bata. I know that when you had the pine tree felled for Pharaoh, it was on account of me, so that I would die. But look, I am yet alive, and at the moment I am a bull.' The lady became very frightened because of the speech her husband had made to her in the form of a bull. Then he left the kitchen. The pharaoh sat down to a day of feasting with the girl. She poured drink for his majesty, and he was very happy with her. Then she said to his majesty, 'Swear to me by God, saying, whatever she will say, I will listen to it. Promise me.' The pharaoh listened to all that she had said. For her promise, the girl asked, 'Let me eat the liver of this bull, for he is good for nothing.' This is what she said to the king. He became very vexed over it, and the heart of Pharaoh was very sore. When it had dawned, and another day had come, the king proclaimed a great offering, namely, the sacrifice of the bull. He sent one of the chief royal slaughterers to sacrifice the bull. It was done upon Pharaoh's order. And when the bull had been sacrificed, and was carried into the hall upon the shoulders of the porters, the bull shook his neck, so that two drops of blood fell onto the floor beside the great portal of the pharaoh, one upon one side of the door, the other on the other side. The drops of blood grew into two great persia trees, each of them immense. A servant went to tell his majesty, 'Two great persia trees have grown this night, a great marvel for his majesty, beside the great doorway of the pharaoh.' There was jubilation over the trees in the whole land, and the king made an offering to them." End quote. Once again, a wife does evil. Bata's wicked wife cajoles Pharaoh into slaughtering the bull, Bata, as a sacrifice. The king of Upper and Lower Egypt complies, and for a moment the wife may think that she has escaped her justice. But Bata, ever cunning, adapts to the situation. As his bloody carcass is carried into the palace, two drops fall from his neck and stain the soil. Where the blood lands, two trees grow by magic. These are persia trees, a symbol of royalty in New Kingdom Egypt. During the reign of Ramesses II, we see statues of the king decorated with persia trees, where each leaf bears a cartouche of the royal name. The persia may have played a role in the coronation rites, or at least been a symbol of the king's longevity, every leaf being an extension of his reign on earth. So Bata, the bull, becomes Bata the persia tree. He transitions from one symbol of kingship to another, and now the story builds towards its climax. Quote, "Many days after this, his majesty came forth at the window of appearances, which is made of lapis lazuli. He wore a wreath of all kinds of flowers upon his neck. Then the pharaoh mounted a golden chariot and came out of the palace to view the persia trees. Then his lady came out on a team behind Pharaoh. His majesty sat down under one persia tree and the lady under the other. Then Bata, as the trees, spoke to his wife. 'Ha! You false one! I am Bata. I am alive in spite of you. I know that when you had the pine tree felled for Pharaoh, it was on account of me. And when I became a bull, you had me killed.'" End quote. Bata, in the form of the persia tree,
now confronts his wayward wife. The woman is in a tricky situation. She may be exposed as an adulteress, for though her and Bata never consummated their marriage, remember, he cut off his penis, still she was made by the gods to be his wife. But she has found happiness or comfort in the home of Pharaoh, so from a certain perspective, she is breaking her marriage to be with the king. What is this woman to do? Will she renounce her place in the palace, or find a way to remove Bata from the situation and once again secure her home? Quote, "Many days after this, the lady stood pouring drink for his majesty, and he was very pleased with her. Then she said to his majesty, 'Swear to me by God, saying, whatever she will say, I will listen to it. Promise me, so you shall say.' Pharaoh listened to all that she had said. She said, 'Have the two persia trees felled and made into fine furniture.' After a short while, his majesty sent skilled craftsmen. They felled the persia trees of Pharaoh, and the queen, the lady, stood watching it. Then a splinter flew and entered the mouth of the lady. She swallowed it, and in a moment she became pregnant. The king ordered the persia trees to be made into whatever she desired." End quote. The wife of Bata, like the wife of Anubis before her, is a femme fatale type of character. She betrays Bata, seeking his death after he reveals his identity. She may be fearful of losing her position, but such an act carries a grave moral weight. Unfortunately, she is now trapped in the flow of events, and unless something quite extraordinary happens, her fate may be sealed. Quote, "Many more days after this, the lady gave birth to a son. A servant went to tell his majesty, 'A son has been born to you.' The baby was fetched, and a nurse and maids were assigned to him. There was jubilation over him in the whole land. The king sat down to a feast day and held the baby on his lap. From that hour, his majesty loved him very much, and he designated him as the king's son of Kush, or viceroy of Nubia. And many days after this, his majesty made the boy crown prince of the entire land." End quote. As the king's agents cut down the persia tree, which is Bata in another form, a splinter accidentally enters the wife's mouth and she swallows it. The wife becomes pregnant with her husband's seed, and pretty soon she gives birth to a child. That child is, well, it's Bata, transformed from a man to a bull to a tree to a baby. In a convoluted sense, Bata is his own father, his wife is his own mother. The idea at play here is what Egyptologists call the Ka Mutef, or bull of his mother principle. It's an idea that pharaohs used to explain how every king was Horus in an ongoing succession. Since the Horus was eternal, every child he produced was, in a way, another manifestation of himself. So, any woman who bore a king's son was simultaneously a wife and a mother to a Horus. In other words, the king impregnated his wife, the wife gave birth to a child, and that child became king in his own time. My favorite description of this is, quote, "The being who is reborn is the incarnation of the one who is dead." End quote. So the Horus father becomes the Horus son, and the whole lineage continues forever and ever. Anyway, Bata emerges as a baby who is crown prince of the land. He is now destined to inherit the kingship, and as the story draws to its close, Bata is ready to take his throne. Quote, "Now, many days after this, when Bata had spent many years as crown prince, his majesty the pharaoh flew to heaven. Then the new king, that is, the prince, that is, Bata, said to his courtiers, 'Let my great royal officials be brought to me, so that I may let them know all that has happened to me.' Then his wife was brought to him. The king judged his wife in the presence of his courtiers, and they gave their approval." End quote. The story doesn't describe it in detail, but after Bata becomes the king, he passes sentence on his false wife. By judging her, we should understand that he condemned the woman to death. Thus, the prophecy which was made at the wife's birth comes true. Back at the start of part 2,
the seven Hathors foretold that the wife would die by execution. Now, Bata carries out that fate, and the adulterous wife, child of the gods but unfaithful woman, dies by royal decree. Bata is now triumphant. After suffering so many falsehoods, so many injustices, the maligned brother has now become an incarnation of Horus and the doer of Ma'at itself. Bata has reached the ascendancy. The fugitive brother has become the royal son and finally the pharaoh of Egypt. The tale is drawing to its end. All that is left is for Bata to make his kingdom good. Quote, "His elder brother was brought to him, and he made Anubis crown prince of the whole land. Bata spent 30 years as the king of Egypt. Then he departed from life, and his brother Anubis stood in his place on the day of death. It has come to a good end under the scribe of the treasury, Kagab, and the scribes of the treasury, Hori and Merem-Uppi. Written by the scribe Inanna, the owner of this book. Whoever maligns it, Thoth will contend with him." End quote. The story comes to its end and justice is done. Bata becomes the king, Anubis becomes his crown prince, and when Bata rules for a good 30 years, Anubis in turn succeeds him. It all comes to a happy conclusion, and the audience can leave satisfied that justice has been done on earth. Sad story, but happy ending. All is well with the world. We have recounted the story, but now it is time for a little bit of commentary. The person who copied this text down bore the name Inanna. Inanna is another name for Ishtar, the famous Babylonian goddess. So it's possible that this particular scribe, maybe a woman, came from Near Eastern heritage. Other scribes are referenced, and they might be the original composers of the story. It's unclear. All we can say for certain is that the tale of two brothers emerged sometime in the 18th or early 19th dynasties, and was copied onto other papyri later. Today, two sizable copies of the tale of two brothers survive on papyrus, allowing scholars to compare the versions and their differences. It has been called the world's oldest fairy tale, and it may be one of the original stories of its kind. Of course, we have already seen the contendings of Horus and Seth way back in episode 3, but even that text was only written down during the 19th and 20th dynasties. So it's possible that the tale of two brothers technically comes first, making it the oldest story of its kind in Egypt. Whether that is correct or not, it is a fascinating tale, an adventure, a morality, and a drama of royal intrigue, all wrapped in one. Of course, there are different ways to interpret the meaning of this story. On one level, it may simply be a fairy tale, a fun story told around the hearth which entertains on the long nights. On the other, it also has some clear moral points. Adultery is condemned most strongly, and ultimately justice prevails, giving a sense that there is order in the world, that good people will triumph over wickedness. Some elements of the story, particularly the Byblos or Lebanon situation in part 2, have also been connected with historical figures of the 18th dynasty. In one interpretation, some scholars suggested that the wife of Bata, whom the gods created in the Valley of the Pine Trees, might be inspired by women who came to Egypt from the Near East as part of the brides or harem of Pharaoh. One specific interpretation even connects this wife with the noble lady Kia, whom we met in episode 119. Kia, a wife of Akhenaten, might possibly have been of Syrian or Near Eastern origins. We have no hard evidence for that, but it has been suggested that the woman who appears in this story is a reflection of Kia or women like her. Personally, I don't buy that interpretation, mainly because we have no hard evidence that Kia herself was actually Near Eastern, and there's nothing in the text to specifically reference any particular woman. The wife of Bata is made by the gods. It's just a coincidence that she is made in this part of the world. Finally, It has also been suggested that there might be political dimensions to the story, that it may be a mythologized retelling of events which took place during the 19th dynasty. I'm not going to discuss those here because I don't want to overly complicate the meaning which we take from a wonderful story. I'll come back to that political interpretation at the proper time because it is very specific to the end of the 19th and the early 20th dynasties of royal history. For now, it is time to say farewell. I hope you've enjoyed this fairy tale, and I'll see you very soon for a new episode of the History of Egypt podcast. Take care, enjoy your holidays, and I will be back shortly. And now, for those of you who are interested, here is the full story from beginning to end, with no interruptions. It is said that there were two brothers of the same mother and the same father. The elder brother was named Anubis, and the younger brother was named Bata. As for Anubis, he had a house and a wife, and his younger brother Bata was with him as if he were a son. Bata was the one who made clothes for him, and he went behind his cattle to the fields. Bata was the one who did the ploughing, and he harvested for him. He was the one who did all kinds of labor in the fields. Indeed, this young brother was an excellent man. There was none like him in the whole land, for a god's strength was within him. Now, when many days had passed, this young brother was tending to his cattle according to his daily custom, and he returned to his house in the evening, laden with all kinds of field plants, and with milk, with wood, and with every good thing. He placed them before his elder brother Anubis, as he was sitting with his wife. Then Bata drank and ate and went to sleep in the stable among the cattle. Now when it had dawned and another day had come, Bata took foods that were cooked and placed them before his elder brother Anubis. Then Bata took bread for himself for the fields, and he drove his cattle, and he let them eat in the fields. Bata walked behind his cattle, and they would say to him, "The grass is good in such and such a place." And he heard all that the cattle said, and he took them to the place of good grass which they desired. Thus the cattle that he tended became exceedingly fine, and he increased their offspring very much. Now at ploughing time, Bata's elder brother Anubis said to him, "Have a team of oxen made ready for us for ploughing, for the soil has emerged from the flood, and it is right for ploughing. Also, come to the field with seeds, for we shall start ploughing tomorrow." This is what Anubis said to Bata. Then the young brother made all the preparations that his elder brother had told him to make. Now, when it had dawned and another day had come, they went to the field with their seeds, and they began to plough, and their hearts were very pleased with this work that they had undertaken. And many days later, when they were still in the field, they had need of more seeds. So Anubis sent his young brother, saying, "Hurry, fetch us seed from the village." Bata went at his command, and the younger brother then found the wife of his elder brother seated and braiding her hair. Bata said to the wife, "Get up, give me seed, so that I may hurry to the field, for my elder brother, your husband, is waiting for me. Don't delay." The wife said to him, "Go and open the storeroom and fetch what you want. Don't make me leave my hairdo unfinished." The young brother entered the stable and fetched a large vessel, for he wished to take a great quantity of seed. Bata loaded himself with barley and emma and came out with it. Thereupon the wife said to him, "How much is that which you have on your shoulder?" He said to her, 3 sacks of emma and 2 sacks of barley, 5 in all, are upon my shoulder." This is what he said to her. Then the wife spoke to Bata, saying, "There is great strength in you. I see your vigor daily." And she desired to know him as a man. She got up, took hold of him, and said, "Come, let us spend an hour lying together. It will be good for you, and if you do, I will make fine clothes for you." Then the youth Bata became like a leopard in his anger over the wicked speech she had made to him, and she became very frightened. he rebuked her, saying, "Behold, you are like a mother to me, and your husband, my brother, is like a father to me. He who is older than I has raised me, cared for me. What is this great wrong you say to me? Do not say it to me again, but I will not tell it to anyone. I will not let it come from my mouth to any man." He picked up his load. He went off to the field. He reached his elder brother, and they began to work at their task. When evening had come, his elder brother returned to his house, and Bata tended to his cattle, loaded himself with all things of the field, and drove the cattle before him to let them sleep in their stable in the village. Now the wife of the elder brother was afraid on account of the speech which she had made. So she took fat and grease, and made herself appear as if she had been beaten, in order to tell her husband, "It was your young brother who beat me." Her husband returned in the evening according to his daily custom. He reached his house and found his wife lying down and seeming ill. She did not pour water over his hands in the usual manner, nor had she lit a fire for him. His house was in darkness, and she lay vomiting. Anubis, her husband, said to her, "Who has had words with you?" She said to him, "No one has had words with me except for your younger brother, Bata. When he came to take seed to you, he found me sitting alone. He said to me, 'Come, let us spend an hour lying together. Loosen your braids.' This is what he said to me, but I would not listen to him. I said to him, 'Am I not like your mother? Is your elder brother not like a father to you?' At that, he became frightened, and he beat me, so as to prevent me from telling you this. Now if you let him live, I shall die. Look, when he returns, do not let him live, for I am ill from his evil design, which he was about to carry out in the morning." The elder brother became enraged like a leopard. He sharpened his spear and took it in his hand. Then the elder brother stood behind the door of his stable in order to kill his young brother when he came home in the evening to let his cattle over the threshold. When the sun had set, the younger brother, Bata, loaded himself with all the plants of the field according to his daily habit. He returned, and as the leading cow was about to enter the stable, she, the cow, said to Bata, "Behold, your elder brother is waiting for you with his spear in order to kill you. Run away from him." Bata heard what his lead cow had said, and when the second cow went in, she said the same thing. He looked under the door of his stable and saw the feet of his elder brother as Anubis stood behind the door with his spear in his hand. Bata set his load upon the ground and took off at a run so as to flee, and his elder brother came after him with his spear. As he ran, Bata prayed to Pray Harakti, saying, "My good lord, it is you who judge between the wicked and the just." And Prey heard all of his plea, and Prey made a great body of water appear between him and his elder brother Anubis, and the water was full of crocodiles. Thus, one brother came to be on one side, and the other brother on the other side. And the elder brother struck his own hand twice in frustration, because he had failed to kill Bata. Then the young brother called to him on this side, saying, "Brother, wait here until dawn. When the Aten has risen, I shall contend with you before him, and he shall make the wicked submit to the just. For I shall not be with you any more. I will not be in this place in which you are. I will go to the Valley of the Trees." Now when it dawned, and another day had come, and Prey Harakti had risen, one brother gazed at the other. The youth rebuked his elder brother, saying, "What is this, your coming after me to kill me wrongfully, without having listened to my words? For I am yet your young brother, and you are like a father to me, and your wife is like a mother to me. But when I was sent to fetch seed by you for us, your wife said to me, 'Come, let us spend an hour lying together.' But look, it has all been turned around for you into another thing, the opposite of the truth." And then Bata let Anubis know all that had transpired between Bata and the wife. And he swore by Prey Harakti, saying, "As for your coming to kill me wrongfully, brother, you carried your spear on the testimony of a filthy whore." Then he took a reed knife, cut off his penis, and threw it into the water, and a catfish swallowed it. Bata grew weak and became feeble, and his elder brother Anubis became very sick at heart and stood weeping for him loudly. He could not cross over to where his young brother was on account of the crocodiles. After a time, the young brother Bata called out to Anubis, saying, "If you recall something evil, brother, will you not also recall something good, or something that I have done for you? Go back to your home, tend your cattle, for I shall not stay in the place where you are. I shall go to the Valley of the Trees. But what you shall do for me is to come and look after me when you learn that something has happened to me. I shall take out my heart and place it on top of the flowers of the tree. If the tree is cut down and falls to the ground, you shall come to search for it. If you spend 7 years searching for it, let your heart not be disgusted. And when you find my heart and place it in a bowl of cool water, I shall live again to take revenge on him who has wronged me. You will know that something has happened to me when one puts a jug of beer in your hand and the beer ferments. Do not delay at all when this happens to you." Then Bata went away to the Valley of the Trees, and his elder brother Anubis went back to his home, his hand on his head and smeared with dirt. When Anubis reached his house, he killed his wife. He cast her to the dogs, and he sat mourning for his young brother. Now many days after this, the young brother Bata was in the Valley of the Trees. There was no one with him, and he spent the days hunting the desert animals. In the evening, he returned to sleep under the trees on top of whose blossom his heart had rested. After many days, he built a house for himself with his own hands in the Valley of the Trees. It was filled with all good things, for here he wished to set up a household. One day, coming out of his house, Bata encountered the Ennead, the Divine Council, as they walked about administering the entire land. The Ennead of the gods addressed him in unison, saying, "O Bata, bull of the Ennead, are you alone here, having left your town on account of the wife of Anubis, your elder brother? Do you not know? He has killed his wife, and you are avenged of all the wrong that was done to you." And as they felt sorry for him, Preharakti said to the god Kunum, "Fashion a wife for Bata, so that he does not live alone." Then Kunum, the fashioner, made a companion for Bata, who was more beautiful in body than any woman in the whole land, for the fluid of every god was within her. Then the 7 Hathors came to see her, and they said with one voice, "This lady will die by the knife." Bata desired his wife very much. She sat in his house while he spent the day hunting the desert game, bringing it and putting it before her. He said to her, "Do not go outdoors, lest the sea should snatch you. I cannot rescue you from the sea, because I am a woman like you, and my heart lies on top of the flower of the tree. But if another should find my heart, I shall fight with him." Then he revealed to her all of his thoughts. Now many days after this, when Bata had gone hunting according to his daily habit, the young girl went out to stroll under the trees which were next to her house. Then she saw the sea surging behind her, and she started to run before it, fleeing to her house and entering it. Thereupon the sea called out to the trees, saying, "Catch that girl for me!" And the trees took away a lock of the girl's hair. The sea brought the girl's hair to Egypt, and laid it in the place where the washermen of Pharaoh did the laundry. Soon the scent of her hair got into the clothes of the Pharaoh, and the king quarreled with his washermen, saying, "There is a scent of ointment in my clothes every day." He quarreled with them, and they did not know what to do. The chief of the royal washermen went to the shore, his heart very sore on account of the daily quarrel with Pharaoh. Then the man realized that he was standing on the shore opposite the lock of hair which was in the water. He had someone go down, and it was brought to him. Its scent was found to be very sweet, and he took it to the Pharaoh. Then the learned scribes of Pharaoh were summoned, and they said, "As for this lock of hair, it belongs to a daughter of Preharakti, in whom there is the fluid of every god. It is a greeting to you from another country. Let envoys go to every foreign land to search for this girl. And as for the envoy who goes to the Valley of the Trees, let many men go with him to fetch her." His Majesty said, "What you have said is very good." And the envoys were sent. Now, many days after this, the men who had gone abroad returned to report to His Majesty. But those who had gone to the Valley of the Trees did not return, for Bata had killed them, leaving only one of them to report to His Majesty. So His Majesty sent many soldiers and charioteers to bring her back, and with them was a woman into whose hand one had given all kinds of beautiful ladies' jewellery. This woman returned to Egypt with the daughter of Preheracti, and there was jubilation for her in the entire land. His Majesty loved his new girl very, very much, and he gave her the rank of great lady. He spoke with her in order to make her tell him about her husband, and she said to His Majesty, "Have the pine tree felled and cut up." The king sent soldiers with their tools to fell a pine tree. They reached the pine, they felled the blossom on which was placed Bata's heart, and he fell dead at that moment. When it had dawned and the next day had come and the pine tree had been felled, Anubis, the elder brother of Bata, entered his house. He sat down to wash his hands. He was given a jug of beer, and it fermented. He was given another of wine, and it turned bad. Then he took his staff and his sandals, as well as his clothes and his weapons, and he started to journey to the Valley of the Trees. He entered the mansion of his young brother and found Bata lying dead on his bed. Anubis wept when he saw his young brother lying dead. He went to search for the heart of his young brother beneath the pine under which his young brother had slept in the evening. Anubis spent 3 years searching for the tree without finding it. When he began the 4th year, Anubis's heart longed to return to Egypt, and he said, "I shall depart tomorrow." So he said in his heart. When it had dawned and another day had come, he went to walk under the pine and spent the day searching for it. When he turned back in the evening, he looked once again in search of it, and he found a fruit. He came back with the fruit, and it was the heart of his young brother. Anubis fetched a bowl of cool water, placed it in it, and sat down according to his daily habit. When night had come, Bata's heart in the bowl swallowed the water, and Bata twitched in all his body. He began to look at his elder brother while his heart was still in the bowl. Then Anubis took the bowl of water in which was placed the heart of his young brother and let Bata drink it. Then his heart stood in its proper place and Bata became as he had been. Thereupon the two brothers embraced one another and they talked. Then Bata said to his elder brother, "Look, I shall change myself into a great bull of beautiful colour, of a kind unknown to man, and you shall sit on my back. By the time the sun has risen, we shall be where my wife is, so that I may avenge myself. You shall take me to where the king is, for he will do for you everything good. You shall be rewarded with silver and gold for taking me to Pharaoh, for I shall be a great marvel, and they will jubilate over me in the whole land. Then you shall depart to your village." When it had dawned and the next day had come, Bata assumed the form of a bull which he had told his elder brother. Then Anubis sat upon his back. At dawn, Bata reached the place where the king was. His Majesty was informed about the bull. He saw him and rejoiced over him very much. The king made a great offering for him, saying, "This is a great marvel." And there was jubilation over Bata in the entire land. Then the pharaoh rewarded Anubis, the elder brother, with silver and gold, and he went to dwell in his village. The king gave Anubis many people and many things, for Pharaoh loved him very much, more than anyone else in the whole land. Now, when many days had passed, he, Bata, entered the kitchen, stood where the lady was, and began to speak to her, saying, "Look, I am yet alive." She said to her, "Who are you?" He said to her, "I am Bata. I know that when you had the pine tree felled for Pharaoh, it was on account of me, so that I would die. But look, I am yet alive, and at the moment I am a bull." The lady became very frightened because of the speech her husband had made to her in the form of a bull. Then he left the kitchen. The pharaoh sat down to a day of feasting with the girl. She poured drink for his majesty, and he was very happy with her. Then she said to his majesty, "Swear to me by God, saying, whatever she will say, I will listen to it. Promise me." The pharaoh listened to all that she had said. For her promise, the girl asked, "Let me eat the liver of this bull, for he is good for nothing." This is what she said to the king. He became very vexed over it, and the heart of Pharaoh was very sore. When it had dawned, and another day had come, the king proclaimed a great offering, namely, the sacrifice of the bull. He sent one of the chief royal slaughterers to sacrifice the bull. It was done upon Pharaoh's order. And when the bull had been sacrificed, and was carried into the hall upon the shoulders of the porters, the bull shook his neck, so that 2 drops of blood fell onto the floor beside the great portal of the Pharaoh, one upon one side of the door, the other on the other side. The drops of blood grew into 2 great persia trees, each of them immense. A servant went to tell his majesty, 2 great persia trees have grown this night, a great marvel for his majesty, beside the great doorway of the Pharaoh. There was jubilation over the trees in the whole land, and the king made an offering to them. Many days after this, his majesty came forth at the window of appearances, which is made of lapis lazuli. He wore a wreath of all kinds of flowers upon his neck. Then the Pharaoh mounted a golden chariot and came out of the palace to view the persia trees. Then his lady came out on a team behind Pharaoh. His majesty sat down under 1 persia tree and the lady under the other. Then Bata, as the trees, spoke to his wife. "Ha! You false one! I am Bata. I am alive in spite of you. I know that when you had the pine tree felled for Pharaoh, it was on account of me, and when I became a bull, you had me killed." Many days after this, the lady stood pouring drink for his majesty, and he was very pleased with her. Then she said to his majesty, "Swear to me by God, saying, whatever she will say, I will listen to it. Promise me, so you shall say." Pharaoh listened to all that she had said. She said, "Have the 2 persia trees felled and made into fine furniture." After a short while, his majesty sent skilled craftsmen. They felled the persia trees of Pharaoh, and the queen, the lady, stood watching it. Then a splinter flew and entered the mouth of the lady. She swallowed it, and in a moment she became pregnant. The king ordered the persia trees to be made into whatever she desired. Many more days after this, the lady gave birth to a son. A servant went to tell his majesty, "A son has been born to you." The baby was fetched, and a nurse and maids were assigned to him. There was jubilation over him in the whole land. The king sat down to a feast day and held the baby on his lap. From that hour, his majesty loved him very much, and he designated him as the king's son of Kush, or viceroy of Nubia. And many days after this, his majesty made the boy crown prince of the entire land. Now, many days after this, when Bata had spent many years as crown prince, his majesty the Pharaoh flew to heaven. Then the new king, that is, the prince, that is, Bata, said to his courtiers, "Let my great royal officials be brought to me, so that I may let them know all that has happened to me." Then his wife was brought to him. The king judged his wife in the presence of his courtiers, and they gave their approval. His elder brother was brought to him, and he made Anubis crown prince of the whole land. Bata spent 30 years as the king of Egypt. Then he departed from life, and his brother Anubis stood in his place on the day of death. It has come to a good end under the scribe of the treasury, Kagab, and the scribes of the treasury, Hori and Meremaupi. Written by the scribe Inanna, the owner of this book, whoever maligns it, Thoth will contend with him. "2,000 years ago, everyone knew that Egypt was the land of magic. The Nile Valley was home to countless gods and magicians who delved deep into texts of divine knowledge, arcana, and sorcery. The temples of the land were home to men of hidden knowledge, priests who performed spells, summoned the spirits of the dead, and even conversed with gods. The Egyptian priests could cure diseases by consulting the zodiac, combining their discoveries with herbs and stones. They knew the secret names of deities and the true nature of every plant, element, and animal. With over 3,000 years of history behind them, the magicians of Egypt were the greatest in the world. So the stories said. 1900 years ago, a Syrian storyteller named Lucian put pen to paper and recorded a story. It was a tale destined for immortality. Long after he wrote it, Lucian's fable was modified into a poem by the German writer Goethe, and soon after that, the Walt Disney Corporation added the story to their musical extravaganza, Fantasia. Over 2,000 years, this story has grown in the telling. Today, we see how it began. This is the tale of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. It began a long time ago in the land of the Nile. Once upon a time, a man named Eucrates came to Egypt. He came to study, for his father wished him to gain education in the renowned temples, libraries, and academies of Alexandria. Like many Greeks, Eucrates would learn mathematics, medicine, theology, and astronomy in the most ancient of kingdoms, and he would have an opportunity to witness the great monuments of long-dead kings, the towering symbols of pharaonic splendor. After spending some time in Alexandria, Eucrates set off on a holiday tour, sailing up the River Nile into the southern regions of Egypt. It is here that his story began. Quote, "When I was living in Egypt during my youth, my father had sent me traveling for education. I took it into my head to sail upriver to Koptos, and from there travel to the statue of Memnon at Thebes, in order to hear it sound that marvellous salutation to the rising sun. But on the voyage upriver there happened to be a man from Memphis, one of the scribes of the temple. He was wonderfully learned, familiar with all the culture of the Egyptians. He was said to have lived underground for 23 years in their sanctuaries, learning magic from Isis herself. His name was Pancrates, a holy man, clean-shaven in white linen, always deep in thought. He spoke imperfect Greek. He was tall and flat-nosed, with protruding lips and thinnish legs. At first, I did not know who this man was. But when I saw him working all sorts of miracles whenever we anchored the boat, particularly riding on crocodiles and swimming in company with the beasts, I recognized that Pancrates was a holy man." End quote. Eucrates made friends with an Egyptian priest, a man named Pancrates. The name means all-powerful, which is appropriate for a magician. Pancrates was a classic Egyptian priest, clean-shaven, dressed impeccably in white, and always pensive. Like all Egyptian priests, Pancrates was also a great magician, and he was able to show Eucrates some of his skills on the journey. Pancrates could command the animals, making terrible beasts like crocodiles or hippos placid enough to ride. Impressed, Eucrates sought the wisdom of this powerful priest and begged him to share some of his knowledge. Quote, "I recognized that Pancrates was a holy man, and through my friendly behavior, I became his companion and associate, so that he shared all of his secret knowledge with me. Pancrates persuaded me to leave all of my servants behind in Memphis, and to carry on with him alone. He said that we would not lack any people to wait upon us, so, after that, we carried on our way. But whenever we came to a rest stop, the priest would take the bar of a door, or a broom, or even a pestle. He would put clothes upon it, say a certain spell, and by this he would make the broom walk, appearing to everyone else to be a man. This broom would go off and draw water, and buy provisions, and prepare meals, and in every way serve us and wait upon us. Then, when he was through, Pancrates would again make the broom a broom, by saying another spell over it." End quote. Things are starting to sound familiar, yes? Pancrates, the magician priest, has the knowledge of animating spells. He can take an ordinary object, say a broom, and enchant it so that it will come to life. The broom will fetch jars of water, or go to the market and buy provisions, and no one notices, for the enchantment is so skillful that people mistake the broom for a man. Eucrates, naturally, was very interested in this particular spell. Conjuring a personal servant using just a broom or a pestle? That is much cheaper than keeping a slave. So Eucrates tried to uncover the secret. Unfortunately, Pancrates was not sharing this one. Quote, I was very keen to learn this from him, but I could not do so, for he was jealous of his knowledge. But one day I secretly overheard the spell by hiding in a dark place. Pancrates went off to the square after telling the broom what it had to do, and on the next day, while he was doing some business in the square, I took the broom, dressed it up in the same way, said the syllables over it, and told it to carry water. The broom came to life and did as I had told. But when the broom had filled and brought in the jar, I said, Stop, do not carry any more water. Now be a broom again. But it would not obey me. It kept on carrying water until it filled the house by pouring it in. I was at my wit's end, for I feared that Pancrates might come back and be angry. So I took an axe and I cut the broom in two. But then each part took a jar and began to carry water, with the result that instead of one servant, I now had two. End quote. The magician's apprentice enchants a broom to fetch water, and the animated object begins to obey. But the apprentice is dabbling with things he does not know, and very quickly things begin to get out of hand. Eucrates, becomes agitated. The broom is not stopping, and he has forgotten the spell to return it to its proper state. Eucrates takes an axe and splits the broom in two, only to find that it returns doubled. Like some kind of dust-cleaning hydra, the two brooms begin to fetch water independently. If Eucrates' mouse isn't careful, he's going to wind up with a flooded home. Fortunately, the apprentice was not alone. Quote, Meanwhile, Pancrates reappeared on the scene, and comprehending what had happened, he turned the brooms into wood again, just as they were before the spell. Then, for his own part, he left me to my own devices without warning, taking himself away, out of sight. End quote. The stern magician Pancrates returns, the spell is corrected, and Eucrates is saved from a most humiliating catastrophe. But he is not spared punishment. Angered, Pancrates now abandons the young apprentice, and we know not where he went. The tale sort of ends here, but Eucrates treats us to a short epilogue. As Eucrates tells his story, the man listening is somewhat bemused by his outlandish claims to magic. Everyone knows that Egyptian priests can do magic, but Eucrates? Pah, the man couldn't bewitch a fly to go in a circle. Skeptical of these stories, the man listening questions Eucrates on his ability. Quote, So do you still know how to turn the broom into a man? Said the listener, Dinomachus. Yes, said Eucrates, but only halfway, for I cannot bring it back to its original form once it becomes a water carrier. And if I do it, we would be obliged to let the house be flooded with the water that has poured in. Ha! Will you never stop telling such nonsense, old men like you? If you will not, for the sake of the children, you should at least be easy with them and not accustom them to hear things like this, which will stick around and fill their heads with all sorts of superstition. End quote. Ah, Eucrates, your tall tale has not convinced anyone. Still, I believe you. Everyone knows that Egyptian magicians were capable of the most spectacular feats. And this is not the only Greek story to deal with feats of the arcane in the land of the Nile. The tale of the sorcerer's apprentice shares a number of elements in common with other Greek fables about this mysterious land. To the Greeks, Egypt was a home of great wonders, hidden knowledge, and of course, all kinds of strange, exotic powers. Egyptian priests, it was said, could practice the art of necromancy. Now, this is not the necromancy of Hollywood, raising minions from the dead, corpses rising from graves to shamble forth and wreak havoc. No, this is classic necromancy, summoning the spirits of the dead in order to speak with them, to gain advice or insight into the workings of the world. The Egyptians would have understood this concept of necromancy much better than its 21st century misunderstanding. To them, the deceased, whether family members or friends, were an active part of the world. You couldn't see them, but they were there, and they could help you, influence you, or hinder you if the conditions were right. Ancient Egyptians would write letters to deceased relatives and friends, and some of these survive from the Pharaonic period. In the village of Deir el-Medina, for instance, we have instances of people writing letters to those who have passed on to the realm of Osiris. They ask them for help, for advice, or to stop causing trouble on account of some imagined slight. Egyptian necromancy, speaking with the dead and gaining their advice, was a tried and practiced form of magic in the ancient world. To the Greeks, this was a particularly fascinating phenomenon, and in other stories, we hear about Greeks visiting the priests of Egypt and having them perform great feats for them. In one story, a Greek man comes to an Egyptian priest hoping to learn the arts of necromancy. He is disappointed the priest is unable to teach him, but, as a reward, the priest takes the Greek to a hidden chamber in a tomb and there helps him to speak with a god. In this story, a Greek is taken to a hidden burial chamber, probably in the hills west of Thebes. There, the priest sits the Greek down before a statue, most likely a statue of the deceased himself. The priest asks the Greek, "Which god would you like to speak to?" To this, the Greek replies that he would like to speak with Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine. Of course, to the Egyptians, this was the deity Imhotep, the legendary man who constructed the step pyramid of Djoser and who had become a god of learning and medicine in his own right. The Greeks considered Imhotep to be the Egyptian Asclepius, so the Greek version calls him Asclepius, but we should know this is actually Imhotep. Wink, wink. The priest sits the man down before the statue, and the priest begins his ritual, speaking, perhaps in the ancient Egyptian tongue, words which the Greek traveller cannot understand. We are given to understand that the priest calls forth the secret name of the god, and this is actually a valid piece of Egyptian magic. In Egyptian thought, if you knew the true name of something, you had power over its essence. So the priest calls out the true name of the god Imhotep, the secret name by which only the initiates know him. Imhotep, of course, is compelled to come forth, and the Greek is astonished when the statue seems to come alive with the spirit of Asclepius and speak to him of all that he wishes to know. Such necromantic rituals are not meant to be considered sinister or evil. They are a simple intertwining of the land of the living and the land of the dead. And for those who believed that there was, in fact, an afterlife, such rituals were a great way to soothe aching hearts, to calm any worries about their loved ones, or to gain access to some kind of wisdom which they imagined the dead must possess. Of course, the Greek was utterly amazed that the spirit of Asclepius himself, Imhotep, came forth to speak with him and tell him all that he wished to know. We're not told exactly what this was, but the ritual itself was impressive enough for the story. Tales like this are part and parcel of a Greek tradition which held Egypt and the Near East to be an exotic other, a place unlike their own rational, ordered society. And some of these ideas have unfortunately filtered down through the centuries into our own conceptions of Egypt and the worlds east of the Mediterranean. To the Greeks, Egypt was an unknowable land. The commoners spoke a strange tongue, the monuments were unfathomably old, and the gods themselves were strange beings, unlike ordinary men and women. The tale of the sorcerer's apprentice fits very much within this larger literary context. And while it's a great story and has made some fantastic adaptations through the ages, we should remember that it is part of an outsider's view of a land they didn't fully understand. The tale itself is engaging, but nevertheless, Egyptian magic is a complex and wonderful phenomenon, an interesting part of their society. Coming forward, I am going to be exploring more elements of Egyptian magic in mini episodes. So, if you're interested, there is a lot more of this content on the horizon. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your patience during my short holiday. I'll be back at the end of October 2019 with more tales of Akhenaten and the world of ancient Egyptian life. See you soon!